Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we're continuing a conversation about historical or intergenerational trauma. Last time on Community Conversations, we introduced the theory of historical trauma. It was developed in the 1980s by Native American social worker and mental health expert Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart to explain an entire constellation of symptoms that a family, community, or a people experience in reaction to traumatic events. America is a country that, like it or not, is steeped in historical trauma. From the genocide of Native Americans to the enslavement of African Americans, right on through the experience of Holocaust survivors in this country, the aftershocks remain. For many European Americans, though, this idea is counterintuitive. Accustomed to the idea of bootstrapping oneself out of any difficulty in life, and having more often been the perpetrators of historical trauma as opposed to the objects of it, they're more inclined to meet the theory with a scornful, "get over it." But recent studies on the science behind intergenerational trauma suggest that people can't just get over these experiences. The trauma is in their genes and can actually be passed down to each new generation. Our guests this evening are Deborah Peterson-Perlman, chair of the Baumler-Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee, Jeremy Neville Sorrell of Mending the Sacred Hoop, an organization that works around issues of domestic violence and violence against women in Native communities, and Kim Young, community and human rights activist in the African Heritage Community here in the Twin Ports. It might come as a shock to realize that the radicals and idealists and rebels of the 1960s civil rights movement, black and white, are now elders who, in some cases, are more than satisfied with the status quo. Kim Young talks about the challenges of coping with historical trauma across a generation gap.
In our community, there was a loss of respect for our elders, because it seemed like our elders dropped the ball at some point after the civil rights movement. It got to a point of complacency and comfort, and we were being taught that with hard work and diligence, you can get to this place of comfort, and it's all going to be better. And it wasn't, because we had ghettos that were filling up at that time, housing projects, and people weren't able to get out. The ways we were taught to get out were through sports. You know, education was okay, but then the education system started to fail our children. So then what takes the place of that? Well, then you got cops in schools, and you got the school-to-prison pipeline, which is still failing our children. So we have this group of millennials who grew up in the post-civil rights era of the 60s, and they were, you know, pushed towards drugs, pushed towards, you know, the gang violence that was happening in Los Angeles and New York and in Chicago. And now we've got this division among ourselves regarding four block territories. Okay. Then you've got people from the South who are coming up who are really, really strong on education and the historically black colleges and universities. And you come North, and that's where we're finding that we're learning our history. We're learning our culture, because it wasn't being taught to us in the schools in the South. And you come North and learn more about what's going on. You learn the real intent of Dr. Martin Luther King, the real intent of Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and what was going on, and things that was being rediscovered by the millennials. Okay, so now you've got this. We've got an awakened, aware youth movement going on. But at the same time, we've got these complacently set, comfortable elders who don't want to give up power, who don't want to, they want to tell you what to do, but they don't want to empower you to do it yourself. So now we've got this divide going on within our communities that are saying, no, it's time for you to sit down and guide us and give us your wisdom. And we've got elders that are saying, well, no, we just need you to do what we tell you to do. And that's not the case. For me, I'm becoming an elder at this point, which was not something I ever intended to be, a leader in the community. And I'm one of those who's like, okay, I'm 50 years old, and I'm now in a civil rights movement. And yes, I know we need to move forward as a people together. We need to unite among ourselves first and then unite with the rest of the world in order to end this cycle of hatred and violence for all of us to become strong and become the people we are meant to be. And yes, I believe very strongly in the seventh fire and the seventh generation prophecies that is what we are entering into now. And I very much strongly support our millennials and our young leaders because they have ideas and they have experiences now that are outside of the African heritage community. Our community didn't become close-knit because we needed to survive. We became close-knit because we were forced into it. We were forced into that separation. So it was always separate in this country, but not separate and equal. And that would have been fine. But when you consider when we tried to be separate and have our communities like Rosewood, they were destroyed because we were able to survive without white input. And it was destroyed because you got some affluent blacks that are looking like they're going to, you know, get a little uppity. Well, no, we got to put them back down in that slave place and oppress them. We have millennials now. You go try with that and you'll see what you get. Whereas you still have elders and people of my generation who were taught, yes, sir, no, sir. And it's a very hard thing to wrap your mind around when you still have that mindset in a way that you want to get along with everybody and you have to be condescending and you have to be compliant to the white people in your community and still treat them with respect, even if they don't treat you with that same respect. And at the same time, I've got my kids, you know, and these kids around me, and they're looking at my lead on that. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, what do I do? You know, well, sit down, give them your wisdom, tell them your experiences, and let them deal how they're going to deal, because it's their fight from now on. And it's our position now to be their guides, to tell them and pass the knowledge on so that they can keep alive. This is the experience we do not want to return to.
In addition to conflicts within communities, there are, of course, tensions with the outside world. Members of the dominant culture who are clueless about some of these issues and challenges, or those who bristle at the suggestion that they enjoy any kind of privilege, create a problem. But in all honesty, sometimes standing on the outside and trying to figure out how to do the right thing, whether you're feeling white guilt or not, is fraught with its own set of landmines. Jeremy Neville Sorrell talks about how to navigate some of those uncomfortable feelings and conversations.
People talking about white guilt, and then you burden people of color with white guilt when you ask them, are they comfortable? Or talk about your uncomfortability. So you got that aspect. Then you got the other aspect of, again, asking to be educated by people of color. I think with the issue around people feeling guilty, it's more helpful to sit with that for a moment and try to find where that feeling of guilt is coming from. Because if you can identify what's causing the guilt, then you have a better cause for action. Because then you can understand it. Because if you're watching a story around impoverished people and then you feel guilty for all the things that you have, then it starts to have this connection to its, recognizing the different economic differences. And so then it puts that feeling into an action versus just sitting in the feeling. I think most of the people, if they're actually going to sit down and have the conversation, they're at a certain place in their life where they have the knowledge and maturity to have that conversation without freaking out. And the conversation looks quite a bit different. There's a different way of looking at the issue. And, you know, not to mean that looking at the issue objectively is to minimize the impact of it, but to look at the issue for what it is and have a discussion around it without, you're still going to have emotion around it, but that the emotion is not driving the conversation. It's the dialogue around that to create more understanding. Most people, however, don't have that knowledge and ability. most people don't have that knowledge. People are getting into the conversation because of something happening that sparks this. And that's why you always get it's one side or the other. Team this or team that, you know. Like, I'm on so-and-so's side. But even that mentality of thinking, like, that's a very, very immature way of even thinking, right? It's our age. It's our development and our maturity and be able to process things and to have that critical thought of it. If it's either a yes or no, then you're not really analyzing it from different viewpoints. It's the whole I win or I lose mentality versus having context and understanding and being able to come at it from that way, because people feel if they're not agreed with, then they have lost for some reason. Or people are just like, I got my opinion, and if you give me a different view, then you don't agree with me. And it goes back to that yeah, but type of discussion versus yes and. And it's the polarizing versus creating a full picture. If it's a stranger conversation, sometimes the spontaneity can really create more of an uncomfortability. Like, geez, you know, why is someone bringing it up to me? There's also this assumption that all people of color are socially aware and versed on all the issues. No, we know our experiences in our lives, but not all of us know how to articulate that. And so those of us who are doing organizing and are representatives of communities of color, we can articulate those things in that way, but there's still not a, you know, it's not inherently known. It's the same thing when we talk about the white privilege too. There are white people who are very aware of privilege and social structures and all those things that exist, and they know when it comes into play. They're very aware of it, and other people aren't. And it's the same thing being a person of color. Some people say, well, that's just the way the world is. They have no idea. They don't really see anything wrong with it until you get some sort of information and start to learn about it, and then recognize those things within your life. And that's that awareness building, creating epiphanies. My favorite line has been that I created, of course, you know, you can't teach epiphanies. People think by going out there and I can do a dynamic speech and all of a sudden the whole room is going to change. And when they ask me to come out and do trainings in a community on domestic violence or work with men, somehow I'm going to tell them something and the whole world is instantly changed. We go away and we talk with people months later as part of our work, training technical assistants, and they're like, well, that training didn't work. Things are the same in our community. Nothing changed. And it's the piece of understanding. So what work effort did you do to carry that out? Because we want the simple fixes. We want answers to complex questions versus how do we come together and understand it and learn together and also recognize when someone's at a different place. And we're teachers in that way. So that type of approach is very important when getting people to have those conversations. And another piece that is really important for working with a group outside of your own is that you have to show up and be present and have relationships with people. You know, I've always heard this guy who did the training always talked about, you can't ask a black person about what the issues are around race and get the full opinion of the black community. You have to ask every black person about their opinion on an issue to get an understanding of what the black community thinks.
On the other end of the spectrum of quote-unquote white guilt is the position that these events are all in the past, that people should stop whining about it and move forward. Surprisingly enough, it's not just the perpetrators of the injustices that feel that way. Sometimes it's the people most affected by them. But can you get over it without an apology or even acknowledgement of what was done to you? Not surprisingly, there are a lot of different answers to that question. Here's Deborah Peterson-Perlman.
And that's very prominent in Holocaust studies. People will say, you know, why did we bother with this? That happened 60 years ago, 70 years ago. We don't need to concern ourselves with it any longer. And indeed, the impetus is, or the onus is on us to continue to educate and to try to make people examine, you know, how did the Third Reich emerge? How did, you know, millennial attitudes of anti-Semitism develop over time and lead to, you know, segregation, because Jews were often on the outside of communities in their own segregated neighborhoods. They weren't allowed to be buried within city limits, et cetera, et cetera. So I think education is absolutely critical. And I think that in terms of, you know, how we talk about it within our community organizations, within educational systems, really is incumbent on those of us who have studied. We need to explore what are those lessons that have modern application. How can we find commonality with other systems of oppression that have emerged more recently? And the other piece is this kind of condescension towards survivors as victims, right? That notion of victimhood is a way of putting down the survival experience. And I think a lot of people who experienced the Holocaust have rejected that notion of victimhood and said, you know, I was oppressed, yes. And one of the questions that we often get at Holocaust commemorations is, you know, what would have happened if you had had guns and had been able to shoot back? It's like, well, it's a completely irrelevant question. And it completely ignores the facts of what those worlds were like. You know, people didn't have guns. That wasn't of realities. And so what? It just doesn't make any sense. So your comments were very fruitful in my own reflection here.
I wanted to make a comment there when you said about that what if question, and that's come up a lot lately on social media, that what if scenario, if you could go back and knowing what you know now. And it's like, and I tell people all the time, I would have gotten a boat and beat Columbus here and told the Indians, sink them all and do not let them go back. And people look at you and it's like, you know, you have to think about that. Knowing what we know now, would we have allowed this to happen if we knew and were able to go back and stop it? Yeah, we would, you know, even though it might change the parameters of, you know, our existence. How would it change it? Anything to us would be better than what we have experienced at the hands of colonialism and imperialism. We might still be primitive. We might still be living in teepees and wigwams and roaming the countryside and living as hunters and gatherers. We may, you know, but we might be happier. We might be more connected with our roots, with our land. We would still have our cultural heritage. We would still have our connections to our spiritual realms, to our gods. At this point, there's a lot of disconnect. A lot of disconnect. I can't, you know, myself place a connection spiritually. I don't have it. I've tried. I grew up Southern Baptist. You know, that was pounded in my head. And Southern Baptist is just something totally different out of any of the Christian sects. It is just mind-boggling in some ways. I don't have that connection. I've searched for years to find my spiritual connection. Because of my native lineage, I searched there. Because of my African lineage, I searched there. I even went outside of the precepts that I knew and searched in Buddhism, which right now seems the best fit for me. But I don't equate myself as being a religious person. I'm a spiritual person, but I have that disconnect. And I think that disconnect hinders me sometimes in dealing with my own generational trauma, dealing with the fact that I just don't know where I fit in. even still to this day, you just don't know where you fit in this country as a person of color.
I think you hit on this notion of assimilation and the damage that assimilation does to groups that had a clear identity in the past. And I think certainly within Judaism, assimilation has been a reality. Assimilation was a tool of survival, I think, for all groups. But for the Jews, you know, aspiring towards citizenship in various European countries throughout the 19th century was one step toward assimilation. Altering systems of practice, religious practice and cultural observance was another aspect of that assimilation. And it's a kind of watering down of who you were and what you valued.
I asked if you can recover without acknowledgement.
I'd have to say there's got to be some acknowledgement, because we've been in semi-recovery for 400 years. And when I say that, I mean, we've been semi-recovering from being kidnapped from our native land, semi-recovering from lost culture, lost heritages, lost languages, lost spirituality. And we've never gotten that apology. We never got any form of reparations. We cannot account public assistance, you know, affirmative action as a reparative norm. We cannot account those as reparations because historically white women have benefited from affirmative action more than people of color. For us, it's in reparations. When I say that, I don't mean finally give every black person in America their equivalent of 40 acres and a mule today. That's not just it. We're talking about reparations where we have to recover and regain financial literacy, where we need the education reforms, where we need the mental health subsidies and doctoring, and where our communities need to be recovered from gentrification, from redlining. There's a lot of acknowledgement in this country, and the biggest part right now that needs to be acknowledged is police brutality towards black bodies. Until we get that acknowledgement and that people start to acknowledge that, yes, privilege exists in this country, and we are still benefiting from those privileges and from what was set in place systemically and the oppression that began with slavery, moving forward is going to be just another step in survival of a day.
I think the big problem with that is it lies in institutions that have been developed and established over long, long periods of time. And those who run those institutions are more about upholding the institution versus doing what is necessary. Because it's the vulnerability of a bad police department. You know, it's not bad people who make it the bad place. It's the institution. It's protecting the institution because it's the fear factor of, well, if we go after and hold this officer accountable, what does that mean for all the rest of them? And so it's not about that individual person, whether they did right or wrong, that becomes the issue internally with institutions. It's the policy of the institution that people end up fighting against. Because I know there's a ton of good people out there. There is lots of people who are willing to have these conversations, but the systematic change is a hard one. Who is really losing out? What institution loses out? And that's the thing that people need to figure out. That critical thought process is what we need to teach in order to create good actions and get people to learn and think and problem solve. And that's that passing on to our new generations that we need to help them to do. Because it was all about Socratic thought, critical thought, during organizing movements, that we look at structures and why this is produced. Not blame people for why they do a bad job, but what creates the opportunity for that to happen. And it's a challenge for the question of forgiveness. It's a challenge for us to really get into that, because in our Native communities, the whole Christian influence is huge, and forgiveness is a key word inside of there. The alcoholism, the AA 12-step approach, people are really big into that. That's a Christian-based model. And so they always bring in forgiveness. But when we are doing our own community discussion, we said, what is the Ojibwe word for forgiveness? There isn't one. And another person said from a Lakota community was talking about that they haven't used that word in so long that they don't even know what it is anymore. So either if it didn't exist or that you never used it, you know, or for so long because there is no forgiveness, it creates this whole conundrum for people trying to move forward. But from our teaching, the closest word for forgiveness is to understand why. It's to have empathy for that person. So you understand why that person did what they did. Because we look at people who do bad things and know that they're hurt people. So the angry people are hurt people. The rageful people who lash out, they're angry people. People who hurt others, all that. There's something wrong with that person. And so the closest thing is to have empathy for that person because you know there's something wrong with that person. And so if that person who harmed you and you know there's something wrong with them, do you really need that person to acknowledge the harm in order for you to move on? Is that challenge? Like, how do we wrap around that? Because we have other traditional teachings that say that, you know, your heart is where you hold your experiences and the head is where you hold your feelings. And it's opposite because people say, oh, you feel with your heart. But no, it's your experiences. You're just taught how you're supposed to think about those experiences. And that's the challenge. We can't change something that has gone wrong or something, a bad experience, but we can change how we think about it. And that's why you get good activists, organizers, domestic violence advocates. It started with women who were victims. And they went on to change and do public policy reform to get us to where we're at today. And that's what it is. They're not changing that bad experience or sometimes not even getting the forgiveness for that. But they change the way they look at that experience and use it for something else.
I think that's wonderful. And I think it really touches on some of the post-Holocaust analysis of how we respond to perpetrator states. You know, there have been a number of survivors who said, well, I have to find it in my heart to forgive. Forgiveness in the Jewish culture is very different too, right? We have an annual cycle within Judaism where we have this period called the Days of Awe, which lead up to the High Holidays. The High Holidays include Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. So you've got this month leading up to it, and then right before Rosh Hashanah, you have to turn back and reflect on, you know, what you've done over the past year and what others have done to you. You know, there's a sense in which, you know, the only person who can seek forgiveness is the perpetrator. And the only person who can give forgiveness is the person who has been wronged. So you can't seek God's intervention there. You have to seek that response from the individual. And with the Holocaust, of course, that's pretty challenging. And as you know, I'm sure, there have been decades of, you know, Nazi hunting and seeking out the perpetrators. Even within the past few months, there have been elderly guards who have been brought to justice. And that seems to have been the impulse with regard to Holocaust survivors, is seek out those who committed these wrongs, hold them accountable, even to the end of their days. But, you know, the notion of personal forgiveness, I can't forgive on behalf of the people. I can't do that. I didn't experience that. That's not my privilege. Only those who have been wronged can seek that forgiveness and can grant that forgiveness. So it's an interesting phenomenon. But I think you're absolutely right, both of you, when you talk about systems of oppression and looking at institutions and changing policies, because what's been going on in this country over the past however many years is an institutional phenomenon, and that must be addressed at that level. and we've got a lot of challenges, but I have great hope that we will be able to reach that. But we have to have people who are dedicated to that change, providing leadership and guidance and direction, and making sure that it's followed through, that we see it to its natural end.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Our guests for these programs about historical trauma were Deborah Peterson-Perlman, chair of the Baumler-Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee, Jeremy Neville Sorrell of Mending the Sacred Hoop, an organization that works around issues of domestic violence and violence against women in Native communities, and Kim Young, community and human rights activist in the African Heritage Community here in the Twin Ports. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.